change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me, don't hang around. It's been a long, time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother and I say, brother, help me, please.
Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch. That signals 8 p.m. Thursday, and time once again for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston, Texas, devoted entirely to storytelling. And it is only here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm your host tonight, Greg Audell, and alongside a team saturated in talent, Hank Rubicek, Warren Holloman, and Mary Edgerton, and standout guest host, Eric Heen, Christy Gorman, Harwood Taylor, and our very own Tatiana Gago. We celebrate the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who show us how stories connect us. Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and Happy Holidays to all of you. We hope this season is filled with everything you hoped it would be and that you've helped make it special for someone else. One of my favorite parts of this season, not surprisingly, is the stories that are told, particularly that teach us about holidays in another time and place, as well as those stories read by children. We will be fortunate enough tonight to have both of these type of stories on air. My first guest tonight is David Watts, who is a doctor, musician, inventor, radio and television personality, and an accomplished poet and writer. His literary credits include 7 books of poetry, 2 collections of short stories, a mystery novel, and several essays. He's received awards in academics, medical excellence, television production, and for the quality of his writing. He is a clinical professor of medicine at UCSF and professor of poetry in the Fromm Institute. David Watts, welcome. Yes. So what's your story?
Oh, hi. We're on the air.
We are on the air.
Hello.
How was your Christmas, David?
Oh, it was terrific.
Well,
we had one of the best Christmases of all time, I think, because my sons both came home from college and from Canada, where they live in various places. We all had a grand time. How about you?
Well, it says a lot about you that they still want to come home. That speaks very well for you.
Yeah, well, that they did. They wanted to come home, and they've had a good time. So I think everything worked out as best as it could.
Well, that's good. I would say mine, I missed some of my favorite people, but was with some other of my favorite people.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that's often how the holidays are.
Yeah, that's true.
You are the absolute definition of an eclectic person, and your greatest accomplishment may well be that you and Warren Holloman are friends.
Oh, I like Warren Holloman a lot.
We love Warren.
Yeah.
And thanks to him, you are here to tell us the perfect story for the season, Christmas in George Patch, A Christmas
yeah.
Story. This will be in two parts, but before we start, would you give us the essential background information we need to be guided through this great narrative of yours?
Well, it all takes place in the middle of the 20th century. It seems like a thousand years ago now, but that's the time that it happened. And in writing a memoir, I looked around for the most spectacular, shall we say, or the most impressionable of memories, and it had to be Christmas time, especially with Mother being the mother that she was, finding such importance in the carrying on of Christmas traditions, that she imparted this love, this passion for Christmas for all of her family, which I think has lasted all the way through to the present time.
Wow. Wow, well, I'm looking forward to hearing the story.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading it to you. Is the quality all right on my voice over here?
I think it's wonderful.
Okay, great. Shall we go?
Absolutely.
Christmas in George Patch. Along about November, the hackberry trees at the edge of our yard go bare. The leaves, never plush to begin with, turn metallic, then dark. And losing their perpetual struggle against the inevitability of seasons, fall away, revealing how close we've always lived to Hutto Road, winding its way down the hill toward Doc Hester's farm. Never knew who planted those hackberries. The trees already tall when we bought this house for a few thousand dollars. Dad just hired as a professor of religion and philosophy at Southwestern University across Taylor Road on our north side. He thought hackberries were a strange choice, not especially beautiful, maker of knob-like excrescences alongside its leaves, dark red drupes that turn purple in winter and attract cedar waxwings. That part we loved. Four sentries standing like a platoon of stalwart defenders at our westward perimeter. So it's 1955, and I've been thinking about Christmas ever since last summer, when in the remaining hours of August, I felt the earth shift. I woke up one morning, and the light was suddenly angular as it coursed through the trees and struck cones of luminescence in the tepid air. Not yet cooler, but already containing a distant scent of winter, penetrating the air mass over the great plains like a heralding call from some winter warlock way up in Canada. By now, mid-November, the leaves have long ago finished turning, have completed their gracious gesture of falling, and the trees stand dark against a graying sky, stripped and blackened. And because of this transition, the excitement I've been suppressing since the day late in August swells forth like a surge of last warmth from a musty autumn wind. Thanksgiving is a few days away, and soon after, the mighty rush of Christmas will be upon us. There have always been rituals for these days, careful pause points to ensure that we march deliberately without exploding too suddenly into wild excitement. a controlled release of tension, as they say, like that of a great poem. When conscious of the nearness of climax, one stops to savor the rising tide. So it is that now, the much-anticipated time for Mother to make her famous cheese batter buns has arrived. I have no idea where these cheese batter buns came from. She says it's a family recipe, though she never says who gave it to her. I suspect she might have read it someplace like the Saturday Evening Post, that mailbox messenger of things elemental to a happy American life, with its Norman Rockwell covers and wide pictures of famous people, copied it down, made her own adjustments, then forgot where it came from. Now, suddenly, it's family history. So we shop for cheese at the A&P. It must be cheddar, and it has to be extra sharp, she says. Otherwise, there won't be enough tartiness to compete with the bite of the onion. Every life has to have tartness, she says. Even better, even batter buns. And as she says this, she screws her mouth around to one side, as she often does when saying something that has more than one meaning. Mr. Swenson cuts a wedge from the giant yellow wheel, and Mother smacks her lips, looking up at the sky, pausing as if to imagine the intricate tastes of the finished product. She taps her finger on the remaining fragment of cheese. That will do nicely, she says. Then it's sugar, salt, butter, all-purpose flour, a large white onion, and poppy seeds to garnish the top. We will use fresh eggs from the Rock Island Reds penned beside the hen house in the little peninsula of pasture that pushes its way over the city limits behind our house. Milk? Why, I've milked a cow morning and night since the age 12, when Dad thought it was a good way for me to earn money to buy my French horn for the high school band. It was his way of installing the values of farm life, the hardships and enrichments he appreciated growing up in the middle of dust and tumbleweeds out in West Texas, values he wanted to instill in a son destined to become a city boy. Mother pours over the block yeast in the cold box as if somehow able to tell which foiled wrapped sum will be vigorous enough to rise once in the bowl and once again in the muffin tins, a delicate process necessary to make the buns light and fluffy. Convinced she has selected the right path, and now able to add to her demeanor the glow that comes from this passionate certainty that every preparation has been perfectly executed, we trail on home, confident these will be the best buns we've ever made. This first little ritual has marked the beginning of a whirlwind of energy that gains in strength all the way to Christmas. Now, at the Thanksgiving feast, the turkey, the cornbread dressing, the green beans, almondine, the mashed potatoes, cranberry sauce, and, of course, batter buns are points of reverence along the trail to the peak of the season. Mother makes us stop to praise every step, partly, I am sure, wanting reassurance she's been a good mother, having little self-confidence born to a demanding mother, Mums, and following in the line of offsprings right after Phyllis, a pretty close replica of the matriarch. Mother became the peacemaker, the one most unsettled by tension and disquiet of clashing wills, and partly, I think, as a way for us to remember the beautiful times. She teaches us how to praise. Walking home from the A&P, she remarks how some of the stores have already put up their decorations. I'll swanny, she says, and pumps her fist in a mock gesture of aggression. They just jump the gun, don't they, David? As the lights in tinsel first appeared in store windows around the time of Halloween, we had decided to shun them, not wanting to spoil the pivotal moment when the season begins by stretching it too far backwards into the unfinished business of autumn. Decorations will get plenty of attention when the right time comes, she says. I am 15 this year, which means that Brother Bill, Billy Frank, is 12. Not yet taller than me, but that will change. He is brilliant, probably a genius, and a true, if untested, stand-up comic. But I am the favorite. Firstborn and a broad family of grandchildren, there is an orange tree planted in my name somewhere in Laredo. I know all this, and I'm sure Bill knows it too, unable to compete with precedents, serving in the role of the one to more often get in trouble, always having his older brother held up as an example, a practice I regret, but don't do quite enough to dispel. Years later, when our marriage is split, the family, like an exploding galaxy, Christmases will contain, along with the nostalgia mother has seeded, the unmistakable tug of loneliness. Maybe I sense this already, the way beauty always contains a little sorrow. Or maybe it's the constant uncertainty of the future that I always feel weighing heavier in times of celebration. Then, like glimpses in a crystal ball, we see that things will never be the same. This particular season, winding its way toward Christmas, seems to be asking for close attention. Mother is ready with her ingredients. We chop the yeast pad into warm water and let it stand. We grate the cheese, never sure if one cup means grated or ungrated, unsure if it should be packed or loosely resting in the measuring cup. I always put in a little more, she says, just for good measure, and then does the same with the grated onions and the butter. Have to keep the balance, she says. In this way, the product is always changing and almost always better than before. This year, no exception. Drawn by the aroma of onions and cheese and yeast bread cooking, I hover around the stove for what seems like hours, waiting for the first batch to come out. No sooner than she places the steaming buns on the stovetop, I have cut open, watched and buttered and melted, and watched the spongy caverns of the still-transforming bread and have downed three of them. She shoos me away and, like hens to her eggs, protects the rest for the table. As we sit around, allowing the feasting of the day to settle, muddled by heavy aromas and the torpor of overeating, we're in no hurry to get out the decorations. I can feel it coming, Mother says, rocking in her recliner chair. Oh, David, she says, it's my favorite time of year. We know what will come next. When the day arrives to get our tree, we'll take down the box of lights that have to be fiddled with until we find the one blown bulb that has caused the whole strand to fail. This is a game of substitution of mathematics and probabilities until the one red flame-shaped bulb Dad had guessed all along was the culprit is replaced, and we're in business again. We'll get out the electric train, the Marks 999 locomotive, and the special edition freight cars to lay out under the tree, and I will spend hours lying down in the dark, watching it come around the bend, headlight ablazing. The glass balls and the one Santa-shaped ornament that hung on my grandmother's tree are waiting in their boxes. I know where they are, but they'll have to wait. Waiting is part of the pleasure. And wait they will, for now it is time for the Texas A&M Thanksgiving Day arch rival, bigger than life football game. Dad gets out a stretch of butcher paper, spreads it out on the kitchen table. He takes a pencil and yardstick and sketches a football field complete with yard markers, end zones, and goalposts. We tune the radio to Kern Tips with his auctioneer staccato-like chatter that paints the images we love, the downfield pass, end run, kickoff return, orange and white jerseys, mixing it up with the maroon. With colored pencils, we plot out the game, play by play, red for Texas, blue for A&M, straight line for a run, dashes for a pass, wavy line for a punt, kickoff, or field goal. We listen for the yard lines to know where to draw the football-shaped marker for each new down, and when we're done, we can view the entire game laid out in colorful display before us. We always root for SMU when the Southwest Conference plays, so we don't really care who wins this game. It's all about the attention to every play and how we can illustrate that on the page. That's charm. Texas wins 21-6. We don't care. We just had fun writing it all down. Dad rolls up the game, wraps a rubber band around it, and sticks it in a nail keg up in the attic, where later, when the kids move away and mom and dad have moved into a smaller house, it becomes part of that segment of history that disappears without a trace. Yet, as we create this memory, I am thinking that one day I will pull out this map of the Thanksgiving tradition and show it to my grandchildren, who have no idea what it's like to grow up without a television in the house, or how important the imagination was in creating an action to accompany each march on our butcher paper football field. Mother has made divinity. By now, our stomachs have recovered enough to step outside into the cold wind, a piece of divinity tucked into our cheek, and shoot a few basketball goals from the concrete slab Dad poured one April when, out of the blue, another of his creative explosions erupted. One day he up and says he's going to build a basketball court, and the next day he damn well goes and does it. We're not very good at basketball. Bill is probably best. I have great ideas about how my shots will swish in from points afar, but I will have to live with whatever comes my way. It's more about stepping outside to the surgical blade of the wind cutting away our body heat overgenerated by a heavy dose of abundance. Tired, our heads cleared of the fog that pushed in after eating, we retreat to the living room for a game of Clue. I have a method. I make a note when anyone shows a card, and I make another kind of note when someone has no card to show. I even mark what the player asks, assuming they will not ask what they already know. It sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. The game folded back into itself, and the men retire to the porch where Dad smokes a bowl of Sir Walter Raleigh. I like the smell of tobacco in the tin, especially the enchanting aroma of Middleton Cherry. I will have a brief romance with the pipe during my days at college and medical school. In my bed that night, I am already thinking about the tree. End of part one.
Well, David, you are making me hungry. Very, very hungry.
Oh, yeah, me too.
And let me say to our listeners that I just put the recipe on our page. So if you are getting equally as hungry as I do, I would suggest you crank up the volume and start baking.
Oh, yeah. They are excellent, I have to tell you.
And then deliver them to the station.
Okay.
David, when was it that you said to yourself, I need to write, I need to tell stories?
Oh, my. Well, I have had a circuitous course with my life. I, as you know by this already, I started out in Georgetown, Texas, son of a college professor and a musician mother. I was pretty good in science and pretty good in music. I was all-state French horn a couple of years, and so everybody assumed I was going into music, so I did. Spent 2 years in music at Southwestern, and then I decided careers, maybe I ought to do something that I could make a living. So I put together the idea of being a doctor and got through college with enough credits and got to medical school, and then had the good fortune of being selected to come out to California and be part of the UCSF family, where I did all of my training in medicine. I decided in midlife that I was going to start writing. And I think, to get to the root of your question, I really did it during a period of time when I was under a fair amount of stress. Things were breaking up around me, and I'd sort of had this intuitive notion that if I started writing, I might be able to understand better the impact that all this stuff was having upon me.
I can understand that.
Yeah. Well, it turned out I was writing a bunch of nothing. I mean, nothing that ever get published. But it worked, and I felt better. I felt like I had more of a grip on things, a better understanding. And so I figured, if I was going to be writing, I should know what I was doing. So I went back to take a few courses out of San Francisco State, and without trying to do so, ended up with a master's degree in English and creative writing.
Just
I
that.
I went to the Squaw Valley Community of Writers for a while. So the truth of the matter is that I'm addicted at this point. I'm writing something almost all the time.
That's what's hard to explain to people, I think. You know, Stephen King says, I'm a writer because I write. I write every day. If I feel like writing, I write. If I don't feel like writing, I write. And I try and keep that in mind because, you know, it shouldn't be a drudgery. You know, it's almost, you know, it's a pleasure. It's like I can't wait to get to that keyboard.
Well, there's a payoff to it. I think there's nothing like, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning when you've been struggling through this thing since maybe
Amen.
11 or so at night. You don't even realize the time that passes when you're working on something like that because you're so immersed in the process. And there's an adrenaline rush that just keeps you suspended over this whole period of time as if it hadn't even passed. And when you finally reach the end of it and you get the ending that you hoped for, it's like what Yeats says. It's the click when the box closes, you know, and that euphoria that hits you in that moment. I mean, you could win an award for this piece, and it wouldn't be equal to that moment when you finish it.
Absolutely true. I'm wondering, do you think writing and poetry have made you a better physician?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, to be a really great physician, you have to have the science, otherwise you're a quack, right?
Right.
On top of it, you have to be able to work with people. And that's the art side of the practice of medicine. I've made a little side career of giving talks in medical schools, trying to encourage people to keep up the artistic side. Because you can't convince patients to adopt a regimen for hypertension, for example, unless they trust you. And they won't trust you if you are merely an automated reciting piece for a bunch of information. The information is largely known already. The important thing is to obtain the trust with someone that they will be able to change their lives and make it better. To do that, you have to have art. And art comes from the things you do that make art. Music, art, drama, literature, poetry, dance, all those things.
I wish you were my doctor. Well, David, before...
I had a lot of fun doing it, I can tell you that.
Before we begin the second part of your story, will you just give us a short synopsis of the first half for the listeners who have just turned in?
Yeah, it starts out, I framed this with the hackberry trees. I started out, I'm going to end up with those trees, or what happened to them. And so I put the story in nature, in a particular location, in Central Texas, at a particular time. And then what unfolded was this crescendo of energy and passion that begins even as early as late summer and slowly rises through Halloween, Thanksgiving, and then has this rush toward Christmas. And we're just poised on the edge of that rush.
All right. Well, let's get into the second half.
All right. What I've just said is that in my bed that night, I'm already thinking about the tree. We don't get our tree right after Thanksgiving, and we don't wait till Christmas Eve like some folks. David, we have to have enough time to enjoy it, Mother says, which means we usually get ours around the end of the first week in December. The weather is especially cold that Saturday. A blue norther has crashed into town that morning, with its high, dark cloud rising like a tsunami on the northern horizon, bringing freezing rain and high winds. This makes the hunt all the more exciting. With mackinaws and gloves, we trudge out to Old Man Ishii's farm, where cedar grows like crazy. I never knew if we asked permission, but judging from my father's sheepish behavior climbing over barbed wire to saw down our final choice, I assume we did not. Cedar trees are everywhere, was his only comment. Irony is, 3 years later, I'll be dating Mr. Ishii's daughter. Not sure I ever mentioned our forays into her father's property. The minute we get the tree in the house, its aroma fills the rooms. It feels like we're living inside a cedar chest for a while, a scent I will always associate with piling over fences and stumbling over rocks in search of the perfect shape. I don't have cedar where I live now, and I do like the scent of pine, especially Norfolk pine with its orange flower aroma, but cedar is for Christmas. Mother plays carols on the piano. as we lift the tree to its secure stance by the fireplace, deck it with lights, ornaments, and tinsel, and run the electric train underneath. We sit back and admire our work. I even get out of bed a couple of times during the night, trying to etch every detail in memory. So one evening about now, Mother will say, "Let's go see the lights," and we pile into our green and beige 53 Chevy wagon and drive through the streets of Georgetown, affectionately known as George Patch by my high school buddies and me, recognizing the ironic similarities of simplicity and humor to the dog patch of little Abner and Daisy May. Mother is bouncing around in the front seat, leaning this way and that to get a better look. Around each corner, as someone else's shrine to the festivity of Christmas comes into view, she lets loose an ooh or an ah. I am of two minds about this. Part of me is swept up in her emotional fervor, but I am also fatigued by the expectation that we have to show her the same level and duration of enthusiasm. "Mums would love this," she says. "Maybe she could take my place," Bill mutters. I tend to agree, but I am puzzled by something. I remember the years Mums came to live with us. She taught me how to diagram sentences, which was really cool. She could be sweet and loving, but she had her rules. No dancing, no dominoes on Sunday. What turned the house upside down was her constant need to be the center of attention, to be included in all family events, and consulted on every decision, creating a rising tension that finally erupted as Dad's heart attack. Mother is speaking affectionately about her mother now, and I am guessing that there has to be a mixture of love and pain roiling inside her. She has chosen between them, it appears. With a nudge against my reluctance, I add my oohs and ahs to hers as we sail through town. On our way home, we pick up a bushel basket of grapefruit, oranges, limes, and tangelos our Laredo relatives have sent via the Katy Railroad, dropped off at the local train station with our name on it. Now, almost everything is in place. As I get older and drift further and further away, this Christmas has become populated by other Christmases. The one with the bright red Firestone bike I probably got 5 or 6 years before, with its puffed-up crossbar and its embedded button-activated horn that broke after 10 days. And the one when Mother, starting in August, made Disney dolls from scratch and hid them in the closet. Then there was the elaborately decorated stocking she made, which hung years after from the mantel. Even all those cedar trees have melted into one. But I know certain things didn't change right away. The batter buns, the cedar trees, kern tips on the radio, the colorful lights around town, Mother's handmade stockings, and yes, even the balsa wood gliders from Kresge's Five and Dime I made sure showed up in bills in my stocking each year. They never lasted very long, finding their way into trees or under passing cars. But my, how they could soar in the crisp winter air. Things change. The celebrations that Mother built around important moments like Christmases and birthdays turn out to be too much for the daughters-in-law. And increasingly, she spends Christmas alone with Dad and maybe a sister or two who drop by. The hackberries come down, and Dad plants two pecan trees, one on either side of a winding walkway I designed with two garden hoses one summer. Before long, we've lost Dad, and Mother sells the house and moves in with her sister in Fort Worth. I call from California, and she still has that buoyant spirit of excitement about the season. "Kiss the children for me," she says. "They are growing so fast." I ask about her music. "Oh, David," she says, "I can't play the piano anymore. My hands just won't do it. But I still have all the notes in my head." Last time I saw my mother, it was Thanksgiving Day. She was lying in a hospital bed in Austin, recovering from her second bout of aspiration pneumonia. "Oh, David, how nice of you to come," she said. And we chatted for a while. It wasn't long before she said, "I think I'd better sleep." I could see in her struggle the wish to stay awake long enough to say goodbye. As I left the room, she called to me. David, she said, you remember, this is my favorite time of year. Before I returned to San Francisco, I stopped by the old homestead at 1201 Huttle Road and stand for a while in the yard. The house is so much smaller than I remember. I picture each room, how it was when we lived there, the basketball goal, the hen house, and the spot near the fireplace where the cedar tree always stood, year after year, with its lights shining through the window. I could almost hear the voices. Then I turn and look westward, where the hackberries used to stand, filled with the crush of the past, windfall pecans at my feet.
Wow, David, that was beautiful.
Thank you, sir.
You know, I feel like I was transported to 1955 Georgetown, Texas. What is your process for capturing the nuances? I mean, I could almost smell the smells. I could see what you were seeing. How do you go back 60 years and capture that so crisply and clearly?
Well, part of it is because the memory is that embedded. Part of it is because the techniques of writing allow you to make little embellishments here and there that I think we would consider to be true, but not necessarily the precise memory. Also, what you want to do in the task of writing is to describe as vividly as you can the situation and the people and the aromas and the touch and the light and the things like that which give an image to the reader or to the listener, because the important thing for the listener is to be able to identify with the situation, the time, the place, the people. If they can't make a bond with the scene that you create, then they don't get that visionary experience of participation. If you're successful, they will feel like at the end of the time when they have read your piece that they were there.
I certainly felt like that. I think I could smell those buns cooking. I really do. And now I'm ready to taste them. Well, fortunately, we have a whole audience of great listeners that keep us here each and every week.
Oh, that's great.
Friends, this is Greg Audell with Tatiana Gago running the control room, and you are listening to my guest storyteller, David Watts, on So What's Your Story? Only on Pacifica, KPFT, 90.1 Houston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. Tatiana, how about telling us about some of the very myriad of storytelling happenings in Houston coming up in the next few weeks?
But of course. Let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, because it's a great place to learn about the art of telling. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel, and that's located at 1500 Sunset. There won't be a swap in December because the fourth Tuesday was Christmas Eve, but do join the guild for their first swap of 2020 on January 28th. And be sure to bring a friend or a date. Be sure to visit the guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for information about all of their upcoming events. And while you're on the guild's page, why not become a member? It's easy to do online. Also, listen to some of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008, all listed on the menu under Radio Program. And if you don't own a radio, that's not a problem, because you can listen to us stream live on KPFT.org and Facebook Live. We're also on YouTube. I guess you can say we're all over the place.
You can run, but you cannot hide from us.
We also like you to suggest program ideas when visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page, and be sure to share it with all of your friends. And we'd love it if you like us when you leave. Got guests to suggest? Maybe yourself? Let us know by dropping us a note at story@kpft.org, and we promise to get back to you. And don't forget our friends at the Moth at Warehouse Live, the second Tuesday of the month, where you'll enjoy some terrific stories. Next one is on January 14th, and the theme is adventures. And for our listeners who want to take their storytelling skills to the next level, why not become a member of Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network? Both also happen to be staunch supporters of our program. back to you, Greg.
All right. Thank you, Tatiana. Do yourself a favor and check out at least one of these storytelling events. You will be so glad you did, and I warn you, you may just become addicted like most of us did after the first time we thought we'd dip our toe in the water. I'd also like to mention that our own Harwood Taylor and Chris Gorman, among others, will be performing at the inaugural Storytelling Fest in beautiful Wimberley, which will take place on Saturday, February 22nd, 2020, at the 7A Opera House. And here is a little ditty about the fest that's had us laughing all week. Tatiana?
Everyone has a story to tell. It's a tradition as old as time. Wimberley's first storytelling fest invites you to come, listen, laugh, and learn. Look at us. We're bringing storytellers in from all over Texas. Houston, Austin, San Antonio, and the Hill Country, too. Famous tellers, award-winning PBSers, indigenous elders, and local jawboners. We'll see you at 7A Ranch Opera House on 2-22-2020.
2-22-2020. The Storytelling Festival.
All right. Next week, our guest co-host Eric Heen and Paul Topekian will be hosting Joe Lurie, a writer and foreign affairs expert who prepares diplomats for encounters in foreign lands. Ooh, I can't wait to hear that. Joe will tell us stories about the often humorous, sometimes dangerous culture clashes he's witnessed in his world travels. I don't think anyone's going to want to miss that. Now, friends, a highlight of the holidays for me is including children in a family's traditions, most commonly by reading special stories. So tonight, I have invited my favorite 11-year-old, Dawson Hilshey, a fifth grader at St. George's Elementary, back to our studio to read The Brightest Light. Dawson was last with us in August when Dr. Thomas Freeman was our guest. Dr. Freeman and Dawson happened to have the exact same birthday, only a mere 89 years apart. Dawson is 11, and Dr. Freeman recently celebrated his 100th birthday. If you missed that episode, I encourage you to go to our archive at HoustonStorytellers.org and listen to our August 1st show from this year when Dr. Freeman shares stories from his 100 years of hard-earned wisdom. Dawson, would you please share A Brightest Light with us?
Okay. The Brightest Light. There once was a little candle named Blue. Blue lived in a box with his 44 brothers, all of them waiting for Hanukkah. When the boy would reach into the box and place some thumb atop the
menorah
for all the world to see. But when the first night of Hanukkah came and the boy reached into the box, he did not pick Blue, nor did he pick him on the second night or the third. And Blue was heartbroken, for he thought he would never sit atop the menorah. Finally, on the eighth and final night of Hanukkah, the boy reached into the box, and whom should he pick but Blue? And the boy said, "Because you are so patient, I'll make you the shamash, and I will light you on fire first, and then I'll use your flame to candle all the rest of your brothers." And Blue went pale and said, "Wait, what?" True to his word, the boy placed Blue atop the menorah, and as Blue was slowly incinerated by the bright flame, he screamed with joy.
Good job, buddy. I think you're starting to feel pretty darn comfortable with radio. What do you enjoy about stories?
What I enjoy about stories is reading them to myself, and the climax of the story is the best part of the story, because at the end everything get resolved.
That's true. In a good story, it does. Do you have a favorite gift you got this year?
I think it would be the book that you gave me.
All right, that was totally unprompted. But Dawson loves knowing more than anybody else, so I got him the Big Book of Secrets for Christmas this year. Well, thank you, buddy. I appreciate you coming on with us tonight. And David, are you still with us?
I'm here.
All right. If you don't mind, I'm going to shoot a few questions your way.
Sure.
Tell us about one of your favorite gifts you've received.
Oh, my. I think, for me, the greatest gift is the assemblage of the family. So when they come from, you know, long distances maybe, or they surprise you. I had, many years ago, one of my daughters had taken part of her training in college in Kathmandu, or actually in a little town far up in the mountains above Kathmandu. And she was not due to come back until after the first of the year. So as we are getting ready to celebrate Christmas on the Christmas Eve, before the day of Christmas, we get this telephone call, and mysteriously, one of my other children disappears and says, well, we'll be back in a little bit. And then they come back. They bring back Elizabeth, who surprised us by coming back early, landing in San Francisco on Christmas Eve, and not telling the parents at all. I think that perhaps is one of the best gifts.
Well, it gave me goosebumps, so I got to say it must be one of the best gifts.
Yeah.
Well, on the other side, what about one of the most disappointing gifts you've gotten?
You know, I never have had a disappointing gift. And if it's something that I wouldn't have thought of for myself, or maybe not in my taste, then the part of the gift that I still love is the fact that someone was trying to do something thoughtful for me by buying or making this thing which they give to me. And it doesn't have to be beautiful. It doesn't have to match. It doesn't have to do all these other things. It's just almost like, you know, giving part of your soul to someone when you take some time to think about what to make or buy for someone. So that works for me.
And what's your favorite Christmas story?
Well, you know, the one that I like a lot is to Truman Capote, which I believe is called A Christmas Memory.
Oh, I love that story.
Yeah, he talks about making those fruitcakes with his aunt.
It's a heartbreaker.
There's a bit of sadness in that story because Truman is a boy who's growing up without his parents. I think they have farmed him out to some relatives who don't really like him very much, except for this one aunt who works with him and plays with him and makes kites for him.
And I remember they make a fruitcake every year for President and Mrs. Roosevelt.
They did. They have a list of people that they send fruitcakes to, and they save pennies all year long because they're very poor, and then they buy the whiskey from the fellow down the road, and then they get to go out and get a tree, and they get the flour and the fruit, you know, jellies here and there. They pick pecans themselves and shell them, and so they make these fruitcakes. They gave one to someone who stopped by at their house on their way to California, traveling through town, and they send one to the president every year. I always thought that was such a great story.
And, you know, one part of the story that just breaks my heart every time is when he says, almost in passing, that the other people in the house aren't very nice to us.
Yeah.
Oh, that gets me every single time, even just thinking about it.
Well, you know, thank God they had each other.
That's right. They did. And that is part of the beauty of that story and the holiday season is hold those you love close.
Yep.
Now, I have to think there were storytellers in your family.
I think there were. Dad was full of stories. We used to sit around the fire out in West Texas when I'd go visit his family in a place, in a piece of ground between Talpa and Valera in Coleman County. And there's nothing out there, but it's farmable land, so they were, you know, they were growing crops and milking cows and things like that, but nothing around. And so we'd sit there and around a potbelly stove in the evening with kerosene lanterns burning because there was no electricity. And they would tell stories, you know, about people who went to the fair and got robbed, or people who were sawing a log in two and chopped off one of their fingers.
Yikes!
Oh, yeah. Or they would, you know, do riddles like how many minutes does it take to cut a log into three parts when it takes 20 minutes to cut one slice? You know, things like that. They would have little riddles that they would sit around and tell.
Let me ask you, what about traditions that you have created and passed on to your own children?
Well, you know, this business of the cheese batter buns is the one that comes to mind first, because every one of my children, and I have seven of them, every one of my children now has this recipe, and they make batter buns on every Christmas, and sometimes on Thanksgiving as well. So that, you know, my mother started that out, and it came down through me, and now it's in the next generation, and all those seven children with all those 15 grandchildren have all been exposed to that tradition that my mother started with our family. Also run an electric train underneath the tree every time. So I think those are things. And then we, because there's music in the family, we would generally go caroling, you know, singing carols in the neighborhood. And sometimes I would put together a little brass band to accompany the carolers as we move through town. Just this Christmas, I still play French horn, and I put together a quintet of brass players, and we played the Hallelujah Chorus at the local church service last Sunday. And it was great fun to do that, and of course it really livened up the congregation.
How do you want your readers to feel after sifting through your stories?
That they have had part of the experience that I have had writing it. Mm. Now, the thing is that it will not be the same experience. A great story and a great poem will speak to a lot of different people in a lot of different ways. So what you do is you put your soul into it, and but you take yourself out of it, if you know what I mean.
I do.
You put on the page the things that made you who you are, that made you have the responses emotionally that you had, but you do not tell your emotions. You do not say, I felt sad, or I felt bad, or I was angry. You just demonstrate what happened. And in that way, people can come with their past, with their presents, with their prejudices, with their beliefs, the experiences that they've had in their lives that allow them to interpret your story in a particular way. What I want is to be able to write a story that speaks to everybody at the level that they understand and can feel.
That makes so much sense. And I want to go back just 1 second to what you said about the recipes, because I was thinking when you said that, there's a cream cheese pie recipe and no-bake chocolate chip cookies that we have been making my entire life in my family, and I think the cream cheese pie comes from my grandmother, and I almost get teary eating them, because as I take a bite, my mind is so filled with every other Christmas that's come before it. It's almost like that recipe contains family magic in it.
Well, you know what? It just might.
It just might. David, do you have a website where our friends can go to find your books and find out more about you?
Well, the books are all on Amazon under my name, David Watts. I have written seven Westerns set in the state of Texas. So if people out there like Westerns, there's a bunch of them out there.
Oh, you're coming back on the show to talk about Westerns. I guarantee you that.
Okay, I have fun with that. You know, I never thought about it. But my publisher in England, who'd been publishing other things of mine, and there are short stories out there, there's poetry out there, there are essays out there, there's a memoir, this memoir is out there. He said to me, why don't you write a Western? I said, why should I write a Western? He said, well, they're popular right now. I said, well, that's not a good enough reason.
not a bad one.
That's good enough for me, so I tried one. And it was successful enough, you know, it made some money and sold a bunch of copies. And so I said, well, okay, I'll write another one. And I wrote another one with the same characters in it. And I wrote a third one with the same characters in it. And I got tired of doing that, so I started over with a new set of characters. I wrote two of those. And then I've written, you know, three or four more. And I had a lot of fun. And then when I first started doing it, I said to myself, I don't know how to write a Western. But I got about
four pages in there and said, heck, I live in Texas. I rode a horse every day. I milked a cow every day. You know, I learned how to shoot a gun when I was 12. I, you know, walked around in the wilderness out there with all the big thicket animals and stuff. I know how to people, I know how they talk, I know how they think, because I'm one of them. And so I was able to bring all that to the page, because that, you know, that's what makes it really sing.
Have any of your children picked up the storytelling baton from you?
I think they have, but see, it took me a long time to do it. I was 45, 50 before I really started doing it.
Let that be a lesson to everybody out there. Just because you haven't done it before doesn't mean you can't do it.
That's exactly right. And of course, I would tell them stories at the bedside, and I would sing songs with my guitar, you know, old folk songs. They're full of stories, you know, John Riley and all those songs, they're full of stories. And so, yeah, stories were always with me and my family and our traditions. But I didn't start writing stories or even poetry. Poetry I started with when I first got started in my late 40s to write. I started with poetry and then moved into short stories. And then I did some NPR commentaries, which I turned into short stories. And so, you know, once you got to doing that much, you pretty well got a sidebar going.
Well, I hope you make a promise to us that you are never going to stop writing stories and that nope. You will be a frequent visitor on So What's Your Story?
I think you're stuck with me.
Oh, good. Dr. David Watts, gentleman poet, doctor, and storyteller incarnate, thank you for spending this hour with us.
My pleasure.
Well, friends, tonight we shared holiday stories that span generations. These stories, among many, are the glue that hold holiday traditions together. So What's Your Story team wants to thank you for sharing part of this holiday week with us and hope you join us each and every week in 2020. I promise we are never going to run out of great stories or passionate storytellers. Don't touch that dial. Make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling out, join us each and every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we will keep bringing them to you. This is Greg Audell with Floyd the Wonder Dog, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends.